Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two beautiful sponsors for you this week, including a brand new sponsor, Web Design Day. It's an awesome conference coming up at the end of October here, October 25th and 26th in Pittsburgh. Go to webdesignday.com. And also, towards the end of October, the CSS DevConf. You could do both of these conferences if you wanted to have an unbelievable end of your October. Go to CSSDevConf.com. That one's October 21st through 23rd out in Colorado here in the U.S. We'll tell you about both of those later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast about sound effects. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks everybody for listening. This is one of our special episodes, which people will be familiar with because of the very kind of dangerous sound that we make during it. It's a rapid-fire show where we answer as many questions as we possibly can throughout the entire show. I guess. No drama. Just all question on answer action. First question by Mr. Chris Callahan, who writes, "Dear Shop Talk, I've been building responsive websites for about 6 months now, and I've occasionally struggled with how to structure my responsive style sheets, specifically the media queries. How do you prefer ordering your queries within your style sheet? Is mobile first really the best strategy here, or do you start with a base set of styles that do not have any width-specific queries first, which I guess would be like a desktop-first kind of thing? What do you think? What's the school? How does this go down?"
I have a pretty good workflow going. You guys know I'm on the SAS train. I like SAS quite a bit. So I break up everything into really tiny modules, like, let's say, my pagination module, right? Class pagination. And then at the end, before you close out that pagination thing, you just drop in your media queries, like from smallest to biggest. So I always start mobile first. This is just me after years of making websites, and I'm not like, I make so many websites, you should listen to me. But I have like seen firsthand for me and how I code that I often have to overwrite a whole bunch of styles over and over and over if I don't just do the mobile out. So
yeah, I see.
So that's where I'm coming from. So that's what I do. I really like mobile first, and I have other justifications too. Like, I don't know, the only place I ever use a desktop is at work, you know? So
yeah,
there you go. That's my thing.
That's good. That's good thinking. I feel like the desktop first approach was popular at first because it was more like how we were already building websites, and then we could just tack on some media queries at the end to handle the mobile thing. So it felt more comfortable at first, but there's a bit of a sea change happening, and a lot of smart people are saying that mobile first is a smarter way to go. And that kind of philosophy echoes out into not just dealing with the CSS, but dealing with lots of different stuff at first. And dealing with kind of that possibly the simplest or the most limited case first, and then kind of stretching out. I don't know if that's the best way to say it, but that's involved there. And actually, there's a course on CSS Tricks that's about building mobile first that kind of explains a lot of my thinking in through a series of things here. So, cha-ching, I guess. It talks about nice. My thing. I actually came across an interesting one that I thought I'd use this question to talk about just for a second, is that I work on a particular site in which that not all of the views, we try to be as responsive design as I can on a lot of the views. Some of them have mobile specific views, which is interesting too. It's not really responsive. It's like, okay, on this one, I actually just need to make a mobile view. So I do. And then some of them are kind of a combination of both. And some of them use, I want to use the same global style sheet, but it's not, it's one of those ones that isn't mobile ready necessarily yet. So I kind of want to serve the global, but without the the media queries in it at all, just so that it's lighter. And, you know, you might say, well, Chris, the global one's already cached, so why don't you use the global one? And, you know, it turns out it's a little more complicated than that. But anyway, you know how you write in SAS? One of the ways that you can approach media queries in SAS is to use a mixin. That's called, you call it like at breakpoint or something, and then you kind of pass it a string. Like, you know, we've talked about before, sometimes I do the mama bear, papa bear, baby bear, or sometimes you just, you know, call it small, medium, large, or however you want to name them. That way that you can update that media query later, and it just gets echoed throughout your style sheet. You don't actually write the media query actually in line, because then it wouldn't be very SAS-like. You'd have to go, if you wanted to change that breakpoint, you'd have to go change it everywhere. It's just nice to kind of functionize your...
I'm actually in that situation right now where I have these breakpoints and I just picked 1,000 pixels just because, and now I'm looking at it and I'm on an iPad and I'm like... Mm. I think I want that to be 1024 at a minimum, you know, or right. whatever. And dude, it's brutal. Cause I'm like, I put 1,000 pixels probably 22 times, you know, already. So I'm going to have to dig through all these partials yeah. and dig them up.
And that's what SAS is for. It's for variables and that type of thing. So, you know, you might as well use it, you know.
It's kind of like, if this could ever change, call it a variable, because it is by definition
indeed.
Variable,
and there's a
right?
number of different ways you could go about it. You can literally use a variable if you want to instead of the string, mm-hmm. you know, or you could use this function technique, which I generally like. And I'm glad that I did, because where I was going with this is that I put in one additional logical test inside of that breakpoint mixin, where I just like checked for the presence of a variable that's like output media queries or not, which is just a Boolean true or false. And that way, before I like, you know, in my global style sheet that like calls all these separate includes, I can just put at the top of another file called global no media queries or something, I just turn that variable to false, and then I can output the same exact style sheet but with none of the inline queries at all. It's kind of like a, you know, just strips them out.
I've seen people do that for IE8 and below. Yeah. Just kind of this like, no, you get the desktop one, peace out, bro. And I think that's
yeah
beautiful.
That's another great use for it. So that's another way of structuring it. And also, Chris Hallahan, think about the logic of your media queries in that you could go mobile first and then write a media query that then like adds some additional styles when you hit that breakpoint, or you could write the media query such that it's totally mutually exclusive and that it like the, you know, let's say there's two breakpoints. There's one that's like kicks in at 320 pixels minimum or whatever, so bigger than that. And then another one kicks in at 480 or something like that. I mean, don't use those numbers exactly. Use whatever makes sense for your design. But like, does the 480 one then like kind of inherit from the 320 as well? So it's just more styles on top of each other? Or do you write them with both minimums and maximums so that they're kind of mutually exclusive from each other? Those are some kind of decisions you'll have to make too. So I have a blog post about logic and media queries that kind of explains how the difference between those, and it's not anything that anybody can decide for you. It's like mm-hmm. it's like you got to decide if your design just if that inheritance makes sense or not. And tough questions, yeah. But you'll get there.
Next question. Brian McCoy writes in, recently I was developing a website that and was tasked with supporting iOS, Android, and Windows platforms. No problem, right? They're all the major ones. God, I'm watching a train wreck here. Okay. Unfortunately, I found out that Android is the tale of two browsers, the stock internet app and the Chrome downloaded from the Google Play Store. The stock internet app renders quite differently from Chrome, although I believe it's still some sort of WebKit based browser. Would either of you have any insights how to test, target, and develop for this browser? Thanks so much.
Well, Chrome on iOS would be WebKit, just because it just uses whatever the rendering engine that's already inside the phone is, because that's just how Apple decided it has to happen. But if you download Chrome from the Chrome Store on your Android device, I believe it's not WebKit. It's Blink now, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, like Chrome on iOS is the like WebKit web view thing with like all of Chrome's little JavaScript engine and stuff like powered on top of it, okay. Kind of bolted on.
So there may be problems occasionally between the two, but probably pretty rare. Yeah.
pretty rare. The problem's probably going to be inside mobile Safari, not Chrome, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
because mobile Safari updates way less often than Chrome. So mobile Chrome.
And that would be the same on Android, though. Is like, so Brian, you're saying that, you know, yes, there is those two browsers, and they're actually a lot more different on Android. The chances are you're not going to need to like target Chrome on it. If it's going to work in either of them, it's probably going to be the Chrome. And you're going to have more of a problem with the Android stock browser, whatever they call that. And I thought this question was interesting because a lot of times you'll see a support chart somewhere on the internet. I mean, I just wrote one this week and I'm totally guilty of it where I say, oh, on Android 2.3, X is broken. Well, it's broken in the native browser on that, but it's probably not broken or question mark is broken on Google on Android 2.3. So just saying Android 2.3 might not always be good enough. Just yeah, because Chrome is pretty common to download, and you can download Firefox too and Opera and all this stuff, right? So like what browser's on that operating system? It's weird to just say Android because it's not actually a browser. It's an operating system for a phone. A lot of people just kind of know what we mean, but we actually had... go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think, yeah, we had a guest on, I forget who.
Yeah, Rick Blaylock. Paul
or Rick Blaylock. And wasn't it Android is a fork, the Android internet browser, quote unquote, is a fork of WebKit 15 or something like that? Gosh, maybe I heard that somewhere. I heard that somewhere. Yep. Hey, I heard that somewhere. Yep.
Hashtag heard somewhere.
Heard it somewhere.
So Rick found out that Query Selector All behaves slightly differently between the Android, not only between Chrome and not Chrome, which would make sense. It was the difference between Android, the browser on the phone, and the web view of Android on the phone. I mean, maybe you were thinking about something else, but I have this blog post and I'll link it up. Whereas, like, you couldn't do document.querySelectorAll. You had to do document.body.querySelectorAll when you're in the web view. Like, wow. What? Okay.
So if you're like phone gapping your app, that you're going to run into that problem.
Well, absolutely.
Or something.
So Brian, this is a complicated situation. I think the world of kind of, you know, documentation writers and tutorial writers should be a little more clear about that. I'll try to do better in the future. And whatever, if you're having a wicked problem with it, write back and let us know what it was.
And the best thing you can do is blog about stuff you found that's weird so that other people can like save 5 years of their life.
Plus stress. One.
Yeah. So
right. Audrey Sitnick writes in to tell us about a project that he works on. Maybe auto prefixer will be useful to your podcast listeners, and links it up here. It's at github.com/AI/auto prefixer. Auto prefixer parses CSS and adds vendor prefixes to CSS rules using values and kind of logic from the caniuse.com website, which is a really probably the best resource there is for determining what browsers support what. It's easy to use. It takes in plain CSS. You don't have to use any mix-ins. And it's wicked fast. He wrote in about this a long time ago, and then kind of we've been talking since then. And I, you know, just recently in early August, he wrote a post for CSS Tricks, a guest post explaining on how all this works. And I thought it was cool then. And now I've actually used it on a project. Which the effect EFFECKT thing that I've been working on uses it, and it's really cool. It looks like kind of I don't know this for sure, but it sounds like Brian Jones from CodeKit is interested, and it's going to be slipping out in CodeKit pretty soon. If you read this blog post, you'll get it. It really is cool. It's even better. You know, I'm a big fan of Sass and Compass. I would prefer to use this than Mixins from Compass. I really would. You know, I like a lot of this stuff, but like you just don't have to think about it anymore. Instead of using a include or whatever, you just write it how you would have before. So it's kind of like I think actually stylists might have this with Niv, like the transparent mix-in idea where you just write border radius and then it, I mean that's always the worst example ever because you don't need to prefix that anymore. But you do need to prefix, for example, CSS transitions. And you know what? I feel like, I don't know, Dave probably knows because he's up on this stuff. But like, if you were to ask somebody who's like, even there's pretty good, I bet if you asked me like a couple weeks ago, Chris, just tell me off the top of your head, what are the prefixes needed to do a transition on a transform? In for like the latest, like a what's like a, for like a reasonable level of browser support today, I probably would have got it wrong. I probably would have tossed a Moz in there, thinking anyway. Like if you it's weird. The answer is like a little different than you'd think it is. And go to the CSS tree prefixer post to see the kind of answer to that. It's probably not what you think it is. Yeah, an auto prefixer does it right, you know, because it gets real data from this real database of actual browser support and makes those decisions for you and then rewrites your CSS file.
And this can be like loaded in a NPM task or a grunt task, right?
Yeah.
So this seems really cool because I think Hamilton Catlin?
Yeah.
Came on the show and we were kind of talking about moving SAS over to a C library called libsass so it'd run faster on
please,
Node and stuff like that.
World, please, audience of Shop Talk Show, get
and
on
so
board with this project.
That libsass is done. So there's now a libsass, but there's no Compass. So this could maybe help. I don't want to say break up with Compass or whatever because Compass is still cool, but like, man, we might be able to get some pretty awesome performance gains by just using Compass on Node with a C library in the background.
SAS on C through Node and not Compass. Yeah. Well, see, Compass does more than that. I mean, it has all the, you know, it has other tools to it too. It's not like I'm like anti-Compass or whatever, but as a proprietor of CodePen, I can tell you that running when you pick SAS and you pick SAS and Compass, it's slow. It's wicked slow. Mm-hmm. And it may not matter for you because you have a few seconds to spare when you're just saving it. But we're processing like tons and tons of SAS all the time. And we can't wait forever. So we have like a 5 second timeout or sometimes it's 3 seconds. I don't know. We mess around with it a little bit. And a lot of people, when they do some like complicated, like 20,000 box shadow thing on CodePen, it'll just bomb out because we can't accommodate requests that happen that often and for that long. But if we use libsass, it would just swath through that stuff. You know, it's like 100 times faster.
Yeah. It's going to be cool. I don't know if it's ready for prime time.
No, it's absolutely not. Because we're using it on Effects 2 or whatever, the libsass version of it. And it doesn't do placeholders. It doesn't do... There's the content directive or whatever. It's actually fairly far behind. So that's what I think they need help on, is kind of getting it up to date. And I'm not sure that it will ever, I'm not sure like core SAS will ever just go C. I think it will stay in Ruby just because I just happen to know that it will. So just because Chris Epstein he actually wrote about it recently that it should just, you know, I built it because it's a Ruby thing. And
well, yeah. Yeah.
That
doesn't
mean there can't be relatively up to date. Anyway, this was quite the tangent. Auto prefixer is awesome, and I'm a huge supporter of it, and I want to use it on everything from now on because I love the idea of these transparent mix-ins.
Next question. Actually, let's move on over to a sponsor.
Yeah, Chris? webdesignday.com. So go to the show notes and click the thing because this is put on by Val Head, who's been on the show before. Val is totally awesome, right? She had a fantastic episode with us. So if you go to the show notes and click on the thing, there's like a little tracker link so she can see that you came from Shop Talk Show. This is coming up.
Always click the tracker link.
Yeah, please. It's just a Google Analytics thing. It's not like saving weird cookies or anything. It's coming up at the end of October. So there's workshops on Friday, October 25th. So that's like the get off work and go to this workshop thing. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then Saturday, October 26th, it's in Pittsburgh, which is an awesome town. Sessions from Aaron Draplin. If you haven't seen him talk, that's a pleasure. Just a force of nature. Talks about all kinds of cool stuff, including work he's done with Obama and all kinds of stuff. Josh Clark, Mobile Master, Jen Downs from MailChimp, Brian Warren, all these people that you want to see. Absolutely. There's the workshops, which are always worth it for deep learning stuff. Lightning Talks, like Chris Cashdollar's there from Happy Cog. That's cool. Brad Frost is doing one of the workshops. He's been on the show before too. We're talking about devices in the future, user experience testing, web typography, time saving SAS. all that stuff. Plus, you get to go to Pittsburgh, which is a totally awesome town. You will enjoy it. Go to webdesignday.com coming up at the end of October here and get your tickets.
Yay. Awesome. All right. Next question comes from Jason Bounce, not Fonts. He writes in, is there a pretty CSS-only solution to style a file input field? The default is so ugly and annoying.
Good question. Have you ever come across this, Dave? That can...
Yeah, so like if you do file or input type equals file, right? Yep. Every like you get that like...
Well, you get two. It's not just one element. It's at least two elements because you get the input and the file chooser button.
Yeah, it's like the file choose file, and then it says like some words, and then those words will eventually change to the file name. Maybe.
Oh, you're right. You know? Like in Safari, it literally is just words. In some browsers, it looks like a text input. In some browsers, there's just nothing there. In some, it has little text that will display the file name after you've picked one.
Yeah, sometimes it's like that little like text input, you know, or like then it says browse when you click browse and.
Would you call that shadow DOM? Because it's like it's clearly built from HTML elements. It's just you can't see them and you can't really. There's no like selector that's like just a normal.
Yeah, like when you type input type equals file, you don't get any sort of pseudo selectors, do you?
No, I'm not even sure it would happen if you put like border bottom 1 pixel. Like, which of those things gets the border bottom? I don't even know offhand. You know, it wouldn't be a big deal to test or whatever, but it's just one of those things. It's a weird element. It's like a replaced element that gets replaced with weird stuff. And as far as I know, there's no specs for stuff like that. You can't do like input type equals file :: button and like just get access to the button. It would be kind of cool if you could. I think that the specs shy away from that for some reason. I mean, don't quote me on that, but I feel like they don't like specking stuff like that out necessarily all the time.
Mm-hmm. So and it could just be like, if they allow us to change it, we're going to mess it up. Like, we're going to be like, I'll just steal your hard drive instead or something. There could be like some security things there.
Well, there definitely is because it's file system access, right? So what the browser gets access to is tough there. But what's true about it is that however much pixel space that thing takes up, you can click anywhere on it and you'll get the pop-up to pick a file. If you cover it somehow with something, replace it somehow with like image or something, because I think that is possible to do somehow through CSS. You can still click whatever that you've replaced it with, like some upload file graphic or something that would be more consistent cross browser. It will still pop open that file thing, which is cool. But then they select a file and then they can't see which file they selected. So I'm not sure what you could do there. Maybe write some JavaScript to like ask for the file name and it will maybe give it back to you. I'm not sure what that's like cross browser either. I've seen plenty of techniques though. What Jason's asking about, like, is there a simple way to do this cross browser? I think there is. What I was inclined to do is just go to CodePen and go to the search box and type in file input and just browse through the stuff there, because that's just the kind of thing that people mess around on CodePen about. And I did that and I found some stuff. So I don't even need to go into it very much. I think you should just do that same thing. Go to CodePen.io and just search for file input. And there's a variety of techniques there. There's the image one I just described, you know, and there's other ones. I've seen ones too that do it all, you know, that are just completely custom. So it is doable. Whether that's entirely CSS, I kind of doubt it. If you want it all, there's probably a little JS involved there, but you can at least do some stuff with CSS. Okay, good luck, buddy.
Yeah. All right. It seems like there's like most people just do some sort of Ajax-y replace and update sort of
thing. Yeah, I think it will give you the file name with JS. That's not a security problem. The security problem is if you were to give it the file path too, because then you know a little bit more about their system, which is not cool. Mr. Scott Street asks, my name is Scott and I'm a front-end developer at eBay. Recently, I have been doing some freelance work, which often includes a purchased WordPress template. I have noticed that many theme developers will have HTML that carries over from one template to the next. For example, the header template, header.php, will open a div that is then closed in the page template or the footer template. I find this very frustrating. Is this common for WordPress, or is this a bad idea altogether? And do other frameworks do this kind of thing too, I guess, would be worth talking about? You know what he means, right?
Yeah, so like you have in WordPress specifically, right, is header PHP, footer PHP, and index PHP will include get header and get footer, and it'll include those two, right? And so like if you opened up your body tag in the header, you'd close the body in the footer.
There's pretty much no way around those two.
Yeah, exactly. And so the same is like with divs. Like if you had a wrapper div that like, you know, for margins on your site, so it vertically centers or horizontally centers, like you're going to have to open it up top and close it in the bottom. So I would say, yeah, it's totally common and totally normal. I agree that it's frustrating, though. That's one of the reasons I switched over to Jekyll, personally.
Oh, interesting.
Because Jekyll is like the Ruby style, where it's like the layout, and then you say, you know, like whatever bracket or mustache.
So the template is the whole content. Deal. Yeah, like it's like it has both the opening body tag and the closing body tag, and then there's just like a yield in the middle or some kind of body something.
Yeah, just some output stuff here is kind of like output sub template here.
That's nice.
And I love that.
I don't think it's a deal breaker, though. I mean, I work with both, and it's not. I don't find it to be a particularly big deal. If you know that it's confusing, you could just put a PHP comment right next to it so it does an output that says, this is open here, and it closes in footer.php or whatever. Because you're just not going to get around. The precedent has already been set. I mean, you have no choice but to open the HTML and body tags and header and close them in footer. I mean, it's just that's just how it's going to have to go. So if you're like, okay, I'm going to allow those two but none other, then that would be weird, right? Because let's say you have a page wrap div. I feel like that's legitimate. Well, you could in your index.php open it and close it there. But index.php isn't the only one. There's also page.php. There's also, you know, whatever else, category.php and infinite other ones depending on how many specialized page templates you have. And now in each one of those, you're going to have to open that page wrap and close that page wrap. And now you have a bunch of repetitive code. Wouldn't it have been easier if you put that opening tag in the header.php and closed it in footer? So, you know, I don't know. Like, do you want like repetitive code or do you like confusion?
Yeah. I wonder how they do it at eBay. I wonder, I'm sure they have this like very sophisticated build system, right? Java or something that they're using to build Java out pages. And yeah, so I guess like, I mean, it's kind of this like scripting language versus compiled language sort of thing, isn't it? But I would say, I mean, I think like, if you can get used to it, and what Chris said, if you comment the what div it's closing, I do that all the time.
Definitely.
Like it's like comment dot container, you know, or end dot container, just so like I know how
I do it all the time. I know somebody how that just tapes it too, but I'm like, too bad, I like it, and I write more of it than you do. Yeah, and I like doing it with server side code and not HTML. There's no reason that has to go across the pipes.
I do HTML just because I'm lazy, but yeah, you're right. So, all right. Hopefully that helps, Scott. And let's get some insight into eBay. We'd love to hear how that works. Jeff Lupinski writes, so I've been having a habitual debate between the SEO department at my job as well as with my other developers, which is the uses of H1s per page. I understand it used to be that we were only supposed to use one H1 per page for SEO purposes. However, my understanding with element HTML5 elements like section and article, we can now use multiple H1s per page. With many conflicting articles out there and all these SEO rankings that contradict one another, what's the deal here?
What's the deal with airline food?
Why is it? HTML5 breaks content order. What is it? What is it? Document order?
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm still of the old school, and I'll put the one H1 at the top of the page just because I don't know. I feel like all of the accessibility stuff I've seen where they like they're it's one of the most useful things you can do. They can just jump around headers. It doesn't really care mm-hmm. which one it is, you know, like it kind of tells you which header level it is, but like I don't know, you just tab through them all, you know. If there was like 100 on a page, I could see that being, yeah, you have to be a little more specific about it, but if you just use headers in general, it's fine. And for sure, Google like honors the H1, you know. So like, does how hip is Google to the HTML5 layout algorithm? Like, let's say you like were super super strict to it, and every single section element on your page you restarted with the H1. Like, does it? I don't know. Would it get confused, or does it like, ooh, this guy's doing it right. He's got it squared away. Yeah, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, even though my sidebar might be a section, I still make the modules in my section use H3s just because I'm more comfortable with that. Maybe I'm totally doing it wrong, but I'm still more comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. So there's a thing like in accessibility called, and I was trying to get it out there, but I couldn't do it. But it's called the document outline, which is like if you just took all your headings and you nested them, you know, it should form like a outline, like, you know, like your junior high paper, you know, your middle school, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm writing an outline for a report sort of thing. The HTML5 effectively breaks that, but it says like we can nest structure elements and use the same headings and kind of go deep that way with the DOM, not just with the heading number. And I think that's super smart. You know, because sometimes things are more important, but they appear further down the page or something like that. That said, I think the kind of still best practice is maybe to number them, you know, in order of importance and how much weight they should have. What you can do, Jeff, is only style your H1s, H3 6s with like classes. And then you don't care what H tag is in there because you're just styling with classes. And that may mean you have to require classes, or you're like all H3s in posts get this tag or this class. But man, it's going to save you a lot of headaches not fighting the SEO guy, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense mm-hmm. there.
You know, and just
trying to do that.
That should be your goal, I think, in general. I think relevant here just slightly, though, is that, like, let's say HTML5 does have this way that you're supposed to do it or something. Let's say despite what I just said or what Dave just said or whatever, whoever you want to, like, there's this concept of paving the cow paths. And if you think that you're doing it the right way and it makes sense to you and that's it and it works and it renders okay and there's not a huge accessibility problem, you can just kind of keep doing it that way. And there's some chance that HTML5 like morphs itself to what you're doing. I just thought of that because I was reading this article about site is coming up again and how like you're never supposed to put somebody's name in a site element. That's not a citing. Citing is different than that. And people are like, okay, enough. We want names in site. So we're just going to keep doing it. And you can update what you think site should be according to that. So too bad, you know?
Yeah. I was just going to add, there's a great article on HTML5doctor/outlines that talks about document outlines. And it says like, the support for these new HTML5 algorithms, like is Google supporting it? Don't really know. You know, is JAWS the screen reader supporting it? Don't really know. You know, so the support is kind of like shifty and spotty. This, you know, report was, or this blog post was last updated in 2011, I think. So it's probably worth like somebody in the accessibility community revisiting, or somebody in the SEO community kind of giving like a end all be all there. But yeah, I mean, I think if you can stick with the strict H1 through H6, that'll benefit you more than kind of riffing, just because you're guaranteed that to work, if that makes sense. Yeah. Hopefully that helps you. But yeah, style off of classes for the. Anyway,
So next. We've already decided that you're going to Web Design Day at webdesignday.com. But if you wanted to like really like kick this thing off, you could go and do a double trip where you run out to in the Denver area, the Rocky Hotel. Mountain area, and go to CSS DevConf first, because that's coming out October 21st through 23rd. It's at the Stanley Hotel, which is a super rad looking hotel, and the interior of which where they shot. Gosh, what am I thinking of? That's super awesome.
The Shining was there, and then somebody else was like, "Dude, Where's My Car?" was there or something? I don't know.
That's awesome, really.
No, somebody said some other like weird movie was shot there. I forget who it was. Sorry.
Jonathan Snook's going to be there. He's going to do a Smacks workshop. Would totally like to attend that. Nicole Sullivan's going to be there giving the keynote. Eric Meyer's going, and his is called Obscure Font Descriptors, which I would love to see because I've never seen him do that talk. It sounds like it's probably new, and he always like digs up some like obscure. Well, it's literally it says obscure in the title, but I'm sure it really will be obscure and totally interesting to CSS nerds. That's what's so fun about the CSS DevConf is it's so focused on just this one technology that it's just great. You know, like the chance of somebody else wanting to talk to you about CSS there is like 100%.
Yeah, no, like go to the homepage, print it out, and circle all the talks you'd be interested in seeing. In like your, it's like everyone. I'm just like,
totally.
Dang it. And you know there's going to be conflicts, and then you're going to be just
so fun. Hurt. And we've gone to one before, so we know how fun it is. So that's coming up October 21st through 23rd. Go to csdevconf.com and get your tickets for it. You will not regret it.
Hooray. All right. Let's move on. Utia Shahab writes in, says, I was wondering if you could explain the difference between web designers, front-end developers, UI designers, etc. I know there are some designers who don't code, some designers who do code, and some developers who design, and some developers who don't design. Who is who? What is their educational backgrounds? I'm asking because I'm a graphic design student who loves designing and coding. Well, there you go.
And it's just concerned about the title a little bit, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, so if, let's say, so she's a graphic design student. She's about to graduate. What do you call yourself?
I wonder what the classes are like. Is it Illustrator, Photoshop, and like printy stuff? Do they have to design a brochure? Do they have to design a logo for a local company? Do they have to, you know, make a design with all arrows, or, you know, or was there a good bit of coding stuff too? I mean, I have no idea where she went to school or whatever, but that's what it was like when I was going to school. It's like, we'd love to teach you more about the web, but we don't know anything. So it's going to be mostly graphic design, and we'll just barely touch on some interactive stuff. It's been a lot of years since then. So who knows? But I wonder if, you know, you're free to kind of call yourself whatever you want. I mean, it's a little early. I feel like, you know, you get a job title when you have a job. So like it doesn't matter so much now. It's more about, you know, where you went to school and what your skills are and what your experience is. I'm not sure that you need to tack a title onto yourself just yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say developer is somebody who like really likes code, like expect to code, you know. Designer, probably going to be more on the Photoshop. So like, is that what you want to do, or do you want to be more on the code? She loves both designing and coding, so that's where it's difficult. But, you know, maybe
I would just call that a web designer then in general. I mean, for the title, it means you design and you do code.
Yeah, front-end, web design, developer, unicorn would also...
I didn't really realize. I mean, I posted this, but I'll link to it, but I posted this big article about trying to kind of nail down the job titles a little bit so there's less, you know, ridiculousness, or that they mean something, you know, when you say them. And I'm not sure I'll have any influence on it, but it was just my ideas. And there a lot of people mentioned unicorn. Apparently that's a thing, right? That it essentially means full stack, right? Or you do it all.
Yeah, like kind of A to Z. Like you're like, you could set up a Postgres database, and you can also whatever, make a vector icon set.
I think that's cute or whatever, but I'm not sure that it will stick around, and I'm not sure that, you know, like, it's appropriate on job boards and stuff. I would, you know, it's fine. I don't really care. I'm not, like, anti-unicorn, right, right. But I would think that if you're, like, trying to be any way serious about it, you would just call yourself a full-stack developer.
Yeah, it's some. That's it's just like this. The whole reason is it's like a mythical creature who doesn't really exist. Right. But you know, that's where you should leverage for mad cash, mad money. Yep, I really enjoyed your post on job titles. For me, I have a very similar post in my head, but I'll post it. I'll get it written. But I think, Utia, you are on the right track, but just pick one or whatever, or just apply for jobs. Say you're a web designer and
nothing clever.
Then nothing clever, and then let them give you a job title. So whatever, or you could write in a book apart book and like make up an industry and become a responsive design engineer like myself. God.
Ooh. All right. Matt Edwards writes, loving your show out here in Sydney, Australia. A lot of the development I do these days is responsive, but in order to accommodate advertising or Facebook widgets, etc., I'm finding that working with a fixed width sidebar is cleanest. Or some kind of column, right? After hearing Tim Cadluck on Chop Talk, I picked up my copy of his book, which is, what is this called? Implementing Responsive Design, right?
Implementing Responsive Web Design.
And I've been experimenting with Display Table Cell. It looked like the perfect solution until I had a page that had a series of short pieces of concept that didn't keep the left-hand area full width. Example here, he links to a code pen. So let's say you have a, you know, like a div that's like display table row or whatever, just display table, because you don't really need the row when you're using it CSS. And you have two divs within that div. They're both set to display table cell. You know, you can make that table 100% wide, but if let's say there's a like big long paragraph of text in the one on the left and then like a Facebook widget on the right, which is like 300 pixels only, that will work fine. The paragraph will stretch out to the point where it doesn't break into that fixed width table cell on the right. He said, you know, the one on the right is just like width 300 pixels, period. The other one will stretch till it hits it and stop. But let's say in that left table cell, you just write like foo, like one word. That's not enough content to stretch that left table cell piece over and hit it. It will just be as narrow as it is, because that's how table cells work in this context. So is there a way around that? I don't know. This is kind of a terrible one for the radio. I thought I put it in here because I pretty was interesting. I was on Nicole Sullivan's blog recently, and she wrote, there was like a guest post on there called, and there was just a little video called Revisiting the Secret Power of the Block Formatting Context. It's like a 6-minute video or something, but it's worth watching because it's this kind of clever little stuff about how you can kind of use some of this display table style stuff like here and there, and like do things like set it to be like width 10,000 pixels or something, and it will kind of stretch till as far as it can and stop. And there's actually some clever kind of layout stuff that it can work with, and they use it a lot in the OO CSS kind of framework-y stuff. So watch that and check it out. I forked the pen and used it to show him how that would work, and then he found a different way since writing this in, where Tim Cadluck actually helped him out and thought of a different way to do it. You might actually be able to use calc a little bit here too, and certainly Flexbox could help with it, but TableCell has more support than Flexbox does. So whatever, I'll kind of link up the postmortem links to this later, but I thought we would mention it on the radio. Thanks for the interesting CSS challenge, Matt.
Yeah, nice one. I think, yeah, advertising is so tough, but the fixed sidebar is like the easiest fix, right? So anyway, Pete Schuster writes in, love the show, guys. I've started working with Rails and the Rails asset pipeline. One thing I don't like is that Rails does the SAS compiling instead of doing it via the command line or with a tool like CodeKit. CodeKit is rooted pretty firmly in my workflow. I was wondering if you guys know if there's any benefits to using pipeline versus just compiling it locally.
Good question.
And then he has another one. Finally, what does your SAS structure look like? Do you have one manifest file with many imports or multiple files, each with their own imports?
Yep, that is a separate question. So we could start with the top. Have you ever used the pipeline?
You know, I have like played with it. I flirted with it. Never, nothing in production.
Sure. It's weird because I don't actually even know that much about it despite using it. What I don't know is that why it's so universally reviled, because I use it and I think it's largely fine. What it does is that Rails kind of like handles your SAS for you. So it's SAS is kind of bundled with Rails. So you just, if you keep your style sheets in the assets style sheets area and you have pipeline turned on and you have a file that's .scss, it will just work, you know. Then you can use the Railsy thing, like whatever the tag is in Rails, like style sheet include tag or whatever it is, and kind of link to it, and it will just kind of know where it is, and it knows that it's SAS, so it knows when that page loads that it should refresh that SAS and make it into CSS if it needs it and whatever. So it's just kind of like integrated into the Rails world. Now, you're already using CodeKit, so that like you could just keep all your stuff in the public folder and link stuff up through public. That would be fine. Here's the deal, though, with pipeline. What you get for free is that, like, when you deploy, then you get those, like, you get, like cache busters up in your links to your CSS files. So, that's a huge, huge thing, right? So if nothing changed, it doesn't change it. But if something does change, you get a cache-busting URL for your CSS file. That alone is worth it to use for the asset pipeline to me. So if you don't do that, but do have your htx set file, you know, set to like deliver all the right headers, so like keep my CSS around for like a year or whatever it is, really strong caching header, you better as heck put your own caching header in there when you push. Otherwise, no, everybody's just going to get your old stuff because you told them to save it. Right. And no way do I want to be in a world where I need to remember changing my cache busting URLs every time I push.
Yeah. And I mean, sorry, I'm coughing on the radio. What a noob. All right. So CodeKit could in theory like add a cache buster kind of thing, but that would be kind of crazy. I think the reason people hate it is because like you feel like you're losing control. You're just like pushing it, you know, saying Rails, do all this for me. And Rails is like, yeah, I do all this stuff. There is, so you're surrendering control and you don't have a GUI. But if you think about it, like you have to spin up a Rails server to serve a Rails app anyway. You know, it's like Rails S or whatever. Maybe you're using whatever, some other fancy server or something. So you have to spin up a server for Rails anyway. Why not just let that server compile stuff on the fly?
And so you lose some of the style injection and stuff that CodeKit does for you. But guess what? Mm-hmm. You don't, because it's actually quite easy to set up. And there's a number of tutorials which you can find. And maybe I'll link one up here. Actually, I'll make a note to do that, where you can just have Guard do it. So you fire up your Rails server, and then you fire up Guard, and you just have to have a little Guard file in your Rails thing that says, you know, when these files change, please use the asset pipeline to compile my SAS for me and then inject it onto the page. So you get the same comforts of home of CodeKit in a Rails project using the asset pipeline plus Guard.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you are surrendering control a little bit, but man, I think let Rails be Rails. That's kind of the big thing about Rails is convention over configuration. So like let Rails be Rails and do its thing, and then if you really love CodeKit, boom, rock that on your blog.
Sure. I love CodeKit. I use it for all kinds of stuff, but on big Rails projects it's just, you know, I just don't all sometimes, and sometimes I use, you know, Grunt and another builder or whatever. It just depends on what's right for any particular project. But
And if you're familiar with CodeKit, like, you know what's happening. You know, it's not some black box. No. It's just Rails is doing it for you.
It's watching some files and compiling stuff for you. And it does a great job of that, and has, you know, image compression stuff built in. And there's the Kit language and the, you know, there's tons of cool stuff. And it does it for JavaScript too. You know, CodeKit's an amazing project, but it's a little bit like a task runner that just is really good at a couple of tasks, you know.
Okay. So finally, his second part, what's your SAS structure?
Yeah, I try to be pretty religious about that my globals, or in a global could be literally my global, or it could be, I usually have per site section globals too. So if you're in like the editor of CodePen, there's global and then there's editor, you know, and global is literally affects everything on the site, and editor is pretty specific to the editor. And those will be the only two CSS files that that page loads up. In both of those files, I treat as manifests, as in Pete's words, that it only has import statements in it. It's just like a table of contents of the stuff that it has in it. And I try to be good about that. So if there's like a big pile of imports at the top, I don't put any CSS below that. All of those little chunks have little meanings, and I break them into individual files so that if I stay religious about that, I end up being happy about that and reusing those little bits over and over and over.
Yep. Like I do the same thing. I use my whatever my screen or global CSS is just a table of contents, and you know, maybe I'll like tab over and indent to kind of hint at submodules,
sure,
or something.
Yeah.
But you know, like let's say I have a search bar in the header and I want to style the search thing. I wouldn't include search in my header partial. You know, I wouldn't include the search partial in my header partial because in theory, you know, the SEO guy might come and be like, I need the search bar in the footer now, you know, and it's like, oh, dang,
right.
Or I need a page without a header that has 800 search bars. And I'm like, dude, I didn't even think of that. So now you're in a
pickle. No sub includes. Almost
no sub includes.
Yeah. Unless it's like just like variables. If it doesn't actually produce CSS, but then you don't need to usually.
I mean, unless you have like a forms and you have like a, like part of your forms is, let's go back to the, like, the styling a file upload. Maybe that's a super complicated file that you wanted to break out of your forms, partial.
It's like never like, meant to be used by itself.
Yeah, exactly. So you're like,
maybe it should start with underscore then instead of just underscore.
Yeah. Oh, I'd probably call it underscore forms underscore file
there
or something. Just like namespace that mofo. That's what I think. But yeah, rarely ever do I sub include, because then you're just asking for like, you know, a rat king of of files to dig through, you know. Choose your own adventure or something.
Speaking of CodeKit, Chris S. writes in, hey guys, I'm curious if you guys are familiar with CodeKit's Kit language. If so, I am hoping you could describe how you are using it or describe some of its usefulness. So the Kit is an open source language that CodeKit invented. It's like a Brian Jones, invention. And some people are worried about that. Like, oh, it's just that you're going to have this language that only works in CodeKit so that if I start, you know, using this, I can never go anywhere else. And Brian says, well, no, it's open source, so anybody could theoretically use this, although I haven't seen anybody else use it yet. So there is a little bit of that to consider. I wouldn't be that worried about that. Like, a lot of times you're using CodeKit, it's literally like for your blog or something. I haven't seen a lot of people do like heavy, heavy collaborative work with CodeKit. I feel like maybe the target audience of it is more like the lone soldier developer. And as soon as it gets heavy to run. But anyway, so then if you're a lone soldier, then you know, don't worry about it anyway. What Kit has in it is just a little bit of stuff. It has like imports in it. It's like something that we've wanted in native HTML forever and they never seem to address. It's just like, you know, but like we were talking about earlier in the show about WordPress and headers, you know, we use, one of the reasons PHP is even used is because it has the ability to do an include, and you go get that little bit of PHP in this case, or just HTML, and include it in another file. That's incredibly useful back-end thing. That's why people use back-end languages. This is like that in a way. It's just at import, and then the name of the file, which can be HTML5 or a .kit, which is this Kit language file, and it will just insert it in there. So now you don't actually have to use PHP or Ruby or Python or something. CodeKit itself can go get that file and put it in there for you. So it's like a preprocessor for HTML in a way.
Hammer for Mac is kind of another prepiler.
Sure.
And it has an include syntax as well, like at include underscore header or something like that. And then, which is just slightly different, like, cause it can non-prefixed or something like that, but like Oh, I guess that, yeah, they're, I think they're compatible. So you can do that at include in the Kit language too, and it'll work. So they're kind of running the gun. They're just saying like, we're doing this. I think it's kind of cool.
It has variables in it as well. I bet the Hammer one does too. And that's really it. So it's kind of funny because even variables is like, you know, I hate to say it, like not all that useful in HTML. So like it's basically a way to do includes in a standardized way. And you know what? They're in an HTML comment too. So it doesn't like ruin the semantics of the document really, even by itself, because it's just a comment. So it's basically a way to do includes, and I'm let your mind go wherever it needs to go with that. Includes are pretty much fundamental to the kind of making of
kind of back to our header footer question from the Scott from eBay. Like, how does that work? So in theory, you could get that going without PHP, which is kind of awesome, right? Like, kind of getting us all. I love it because it's these sort of things are allowing us to just think about HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Like, we're starting to we're able to kind of break away from like, oh, I'm going to need a backend for this or whatever. I think it's kind of cool. I don't really care what the backend sends me, a front end developer. I just need, you know, sort of some models or whatever to play with. Data to play with.
Indeed.
Well, cool. I think that is our final question for the day, Chris.
Yep, that's it.
We did it. Another rapid fire
episode. All right, enjoy, folks, and do the thing where you rate us up on iTunes and buy t-shirts and be nice to us, send in questions. We like it very much doing this show. This is number 84. Questions. So we're just rubbing our hands together waiting for 100, in which...
We're going to have to get big on 100, man. Know, fireworks, Trans-American
Pipeline. I've dropped the ball on it before. Pardon? I did the 100th screencast on CSS Tricks and all. I just did a screencast.
I didn't do anything at all,
and it was sad. Remember when Boag World hit 100 episodes? There was like, welcome to our 100th episode! And they like used it in the opening of the show from then on, and it was awesome.
Yeah. Dude, they did like a 24-hour super show.
That's kind of a good idea.
Or something.
I don't know if I have 24 hours in me, but I have 24 minutes.
I would love a like super cheesy like, dear Shop Talk, you answered my question totally wrong. Oh, just a bunch of those.
Oh, an outtake.
That would be great.
Write in something you don't like about Shop Talk.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. No, don't do that. I'm sure I have a very fragile emotional system.
Me too, man. It really hit yesterday. I found a Reddit thread that was essentially about me as a person.
Ooh, yeah,
I'll have to share it to you. And somebody's like, you know, says people like, oh, I wrote in and he was super helpful to me and did this stuff, but he's a bit full of himself. I'm like, oh, I mean, I literally helped you and you still don't like me? What else can I do? Anyway, don't feel bad for me. I understand that maybe I am full of myself. I don't know. Maybe I'm a big jerk.
Hey, I got a chipped tooth, so that's pretty cool.
My dog farted in the middle of this episode, and it stinks so bad, and I didn't even say anything. That's how professional I am.
See? Look at us, a bunch of professionals. I guess we should say, if you're listening to this episode, chances of me having a child now are very, very high. So,
it's not Uncle Dave anymore. It's Dad to Dave. Uncle Daddy,
I know.
Dave.
Big changes afoot. So, anyway, we'll be kind of.
Yeah, and you know what? We might miss an episode here and there. I mean, it's baby time. So, obviously, that's a top priority. And we'll try not to. But if we do, we do. And we'll be back. Don't worry about it.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Really, really appreciate it.
ShopTalkShow.com.
Nailed it.